Hey guys, before we get started with the episode, I did want to issue a correction for last week's episode. The whole episode, I was calling the victim Kyrian Knox, and that is not how you pronounce his name, and I am so sorry that I did not catch it. It looks like Kyrian the way it's spelled, so in my mind, that's just how it was pronounced, but the actual correct pronunciation of his name is Kyrian. So Kyrian Knox was the victim of the last episode. I did write a correction on it, but I did want to pronounce it correctly for you guys this week.
So, as we've been asking the last couple of weeks, if you had registered to vote or filled out the census, to let us know, and we would give you a shout out. So we got our first official somebody letting us know. So shout out to Lisa Penner from Fresno, who actually is registered to vote, and her family did the census. So all of her family is counting so that we can get some awesome services for Fresno County. So just way to go, Lisa and the Penner family. Oh, and the Friesen family, because she's married.
So woohoo! Shout out. Good job, guys.
Woo!
If you want to be shouted out on our next episode, make sure to email us, Facebook message us, Instagram message us. If you know us personally, shoot us a text. Let us know. We will shout you out in the next episode.
Absolutely. So let's get to our new episode. I don't know if I was close. I think I was pretty close.
You might have been. Welcome, everybody, to State of Murder. I'm your host, Selena Cooper.
And I'm your other host, Amber Ratzliff.
And we're coming to you live from Mississippi. Just kidding, we're not in Mississippi.
I'm like, and live, really? Okay.
No, sure. We're not.
We're live right now, you and me, face like in the video, looking at each other.
Yeah, this is real time right now when we're recording.
not fake time.
We're still in California, where things are very smoky.
Yeah.
Right now, we cannot see a whole lot, or even in the Central Valley, we're not super, super close to any of the fires, but it's like, it almost looks like fog outside.
Yeah. The sun is red, like, just is always red in the sky. And I'm like, are we in purgatory? It's awful. And you can't, like, you go outside and you actually are breathing ash, even though, like, the fires aren't near us. Like, it funnels down because we're in the valley. So everything gets funneled down to us and up to us, all around us. So my asthma has been especially bad this week, which sucks. So sorry if my breathing is like, sometimes, because that's how I feel 90% of the time right now. I feel like I have about 70% of my usual oxygen, and I'm already low. So, it's okay. I'll survive. People have it worse.
Yeah. We're getting through it together. Californians, we're tough.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if you'd be considered... You'd be considered a Californian. You live here right now.
And I've lived here for 16 years, 17 years. So, that's a pretty long time.
There you go. Yeah.
I'm like, what's 2003 from here? Yeah, 17 years. I've actually lived here the longest amount of time as anywhere. So really, I probably should claim California as my home state. But whatever.
All right. So I think we got some long cases to talk about this week. So why don't we just jump right in here? Oh, first, have you ever been to Mississippi?
No.
No, neither have I. So... looking up a new state, and I don't think either of us picked a big city,
or not maybe super, you did. Mine's not super big, so it wasn't the main.
What's the capital of Mississippi?
Jacksonville, right?
No, is it?
I think so. Yeah, we always, whenever we do this thing, I'm like, why do we always ask these questions? And then I feel so stupid.
I know. Hey Google, what's the capital of Mississippi?
Jackson. I was close.
Jacksonville is Florida.
I just like, added a ville. Right. Whatever. I was close.
All right. It so counts. Yeah, neither of us picked the capital.
No.
But let's Get to it. What story do you have for us this week?
All right. So this week I'm going to be talking to you guys about the community of Greenwood, Mississippi, and the horrible murders of Shantarika, Dominique, Antonio Jackson. So, and then Andrew Kairo. I'm going to pronounce his last name wrong. Kairo Jr. So sorry if I'm pronouncing Andrew's name, last name incorrectly. My bad. So on November 1st, 1990, Martha Jackson decided to head to church and she took her four oldest grandchildren with her. Now, this wasn't on a Sunday morning service. This was actually a Thursday night service at Sweet Home Church of God in Christ. So she only took the four oldest children. Mrs. Jackson ended up leaving her house around 7 p.m., leaving her daughter Regina behind to watch all of the younger children of the family. So Regina actually had two daughters, Dominique, who was 5, and Shantarika, who was 2. Regina was also watching her nieces and nephews that night. So there was Sarah, who was 11, Antonia, who was 3, Andrew was 2, and Andrea was 1. So that night, Regina had all the kids sitting down to watch Thursday night TV, except for her daughter Dominique, who was already in bed asleep. And I can totally remember watching Thursday night TVs in 1990. It was The Cosby Show, and then A Different World, and then Cheers. So, nice. So, I mean, now, like, we hear Cosby Show, and it kind of gives you a little... because of Bill Cosby. But back then, it was totally the show to watch. So I could totally picture me and my brother sitting and watching it on a Thursday night, just like this family did. And then I actually believe I read that they were watching The Cosby Show. So when I like heard Thursday night, I already knew because it was like Thursday night and then you had Friday night, like TGIF. Mm-hmm. So they were sitting down watching The Cosby Show. So which means that was probably about 8 p.m. when there was a knock on the door. Regina got up to answer the door and there stood her older brother, Henry Curtis Jackson Jr. He actually goes by the name Curtis, so he doesn't go by the name Henry. Now, Curtis seemed to have planned everything out for what was about to happen, as according to court documents, he had parked more than 2 blocks away from his mother's house, and when he got to the house, the first thing he did was he went behind it and ended up cutting the phone line. They had landlines back then. Then he ended up knocking on the door. What happens next, I had to sort of piece together from different accounts and testimony given, so everybody who survived has a different kind of story, and so they kind of all merged. Mm-hmm. So I kind of took a little bit from every perspective.
Okay.
So I did my best to put it together because it got a little muddled and confusing. But so once Curtis entered the house, he ended up asking Regina if she had any cigarettes. He ended up then rushing to the bathroom like he was going to be sick. And he came out and asked her to make him something because he had an upset stomach. So it doesn't say if she went to the kitchen to cook, but that's, I'm guessing. Then he ended up grabbing the phone and stated to everybody, the phone isn't working. So Regina decided to go over and try the phone at the neighbor's house and try to kind of like call the phone and see if like, I don't know, if maybe it was dead or maybe they just weren't hearing a dial tone, but it would ring. So as Regina was leaving, her daughter Shantarika was following her around and Curtis ended up turning to his 11-year-old niece, Sarah, and asking her if her Uncle Greg or Johnny was going to be coming over. All the while he was talking to her, he was starting to put on gloves and started to wipe down like the door handles that he had been touching. And then while he was doing that, he actually asked Sarah to go get Regina from going outside. So she had left to go to the neighbors. And so he asked her to go get her to come back inside. When Regina returned, she asked Curtis what he wanted. So they were in the kitchen. Curtis ended up grabbing her from behind and putting his hand around her neck and stated that he was there to get his mom, I guess, had a safe. It sounds like she actually had two different safes, but he knew that she kept one safe in her bedroom closet. So Curtis demanded that Regina give her not only the combination for the safe, but also he thought she had just been paid so that she had a paycheck. And Regina told him that she didn't have any money. So in response to this, Curtis took out multiple knives and ended up stabbing one into her neck and one into her stomach. Oh my God. I know. It's like it went from 0 to 60. Like he just came. He had an upset stomach. You know, this is her older brother. Like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
After Regina was stabbed, she ended up calling out for her niece. So Sarah, the 11-year-old. And so Sarah came running in to the kitchen area to see what was happening. And when she saw it, she noticed her uncle had stabbed her aunt. And so she ended up jumping on Curtis's back and kind of fighting with him. So they all three started to struggle. And that's apparently when Curtis told him that he had plans to kill all of them in the house. And so Sarah started to beg for him just to leave and take the safe. Like, they didn't care. Sadly, though, the other children ended up following Sarah into the room. But Curtis was like, told them, I guess, to get out and kind of walk them back to the living room and told the little kids to stay where they were. And apparently they did for a little bit. So Curtis thought that he knew. So remember, he wanted the safe. So he wanted the combination for the safe. And so he thought like the combination to the safe had been put in like a foot locker at the end of a bed that was locked up. So he ended up kind of dragging Regina to that room. However, Curtis couldn't get the foot locker open. So he became even angrier and he actually ended up stabbing Sarah in the neck. So far we have Regina stabbed and Sarah stabbed. Curtis then ended up tying up Sarah and he was going to tie up Regina. But for some reason, Curtis had, when he was in the bathroom, taken off the, I'm guessing they were towel rods because it just explains them as, like, metal rods that he got from the bathroom.
Oh.
You know, so, like, you know, like, maybe ripping them off the wall. So I'm guessing that's kind of what they were. And maybe he was trying to use, I don't know why he brought them into the room. So maybe he was trying to use them to pry open the foot locker mm-hmm. to see if the combination to the safe was in there. But anyway, so when he was tying up Sarah, Regina actually ended up grabbing one of the metal rods and started beating Curtis with it. So fighting back. So strong wow. woman, like yeah. having already been stabbed in the stomach and the neck. And she had the wherewithal to fight back still.
Did it say how big the knives were? Like, were they kitchen knives or were they little pocket
knives? I don't think they were kitchen knives because he had them on him before he got to the house. Okay. So it didn't actually describe those knives. There are some kitchen knives that come into play in a little bit, but not then. So I just think maybe pocket knives or I don't know. That was a good question.
I was just wondering to picture how deep her stab wounds mm-hmm. went.
Yeah.
Because you get stabbed in the neck. You have so many arteries and things in there.
I know. It's so amazing that they didn't hit the carotid artery because you'd bleed out in mm-hmm. seconds if you got stabbed there. But yeah. No, it didn't say. So as Regina is hitting him with the towel rod, I guess somehow Regina's 1-year-old niece, Andrea, ended up coming into the room. And so Curtis picked her up and was using her as a shield. So, I know. So, this, of course, made Regina stop hitting him because she wasn't going to hit her niece. And so, she drops the rod and Curtis ends up tying her up with a belt and then stabbed her again in the neck. So, maybe to, really subdue her. Now, if I know, this is it goes from 0 to 60. No real reason other than he just wanted his mom safe. So there's no real premeditation. It did say that he was under, he was a drug user. And so there is some speculation he needed the money to buy crack. So maybe
how much was in those safes?
I have no idea. It doesn't ever actually say if Mrs. Jackson kept a lot of money or anything in her safes, but he was her son, so maybe he had some idea. So if that wasn't really bad, I'm just going to give you some context here that the next stuff is really gruesome and awful as he turns all of his attention to the little children in the home. Aww. So if you don't want to hear about a lot of stabbing going on against children. Fast forward this part.
Yeah, so, I'll put a timestamp in the description.
So while Regina lay there watching Curtis, he ended up picking up her 2-year-old daughter, Shantarika, by the hair and ended up just stabbing her in the neck. So he ended up severing her trachea and he just ended up laying her on the bed. So Curtis then went to the safe and started dragging it down the hallway. So I'm guessing the safe wasn't bolted down. Like, a lot of safes are usually...
How big was it?
I don't know. I'm guessing... Because he had to drag it. So my brother has a safe that I bought him. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, foot by foot square. And it is freaking heavy. I want to say it's like 90, 100 pounds. So, I mean, if it's even smaller, safes are pretty heavy. So maybe like that. Yeah. But I mean, he was a pretty big guy, so I think he could carry that. So maybe it was a bit bigger than that. Sadly, all of this noise being drugged down the hall ended up waking up Regina's 5-year-old daughter, Dominique, who came out of her bedroom calling for her mother and ended up encountering her uncle, Curtis. Regina could hear him talking to her. So Curtis ended up telling her that he loved her. And then he ended up stabbing her in the neck and then just threw her onto the floor in the hallway. I don't know if he is like having some sort of psychosis. I don't know. Like, it just seems.
Was he under the influence?
There is some speculation that he was, and especially because he was weirdly sick when he first got there. And, you know, just it doesn't sound like this was something that they would have suspected him of doing. So yeah. I don't know. Something was going on. After he ended up stabbing Dominique in the neck, he actually did hit the carotid artery, so she bled out fairly quickly. Curtis then returned to Regina and then again stabbed her in the neck. So now this is, what, 3 or 4 different times she's been stabbed in the neck, and she already has her stomach wound. So Regina just decided that she would lay there and pretend that she was dead at that point, even though she wasn't. So while all of this was happening, Sarah, so remember, she's only 11 years old, so, and she's already been stabbed, so was trying to comfort her little 1-year-old sister and trying to get her brother Antonio to run for help. However, Curtis heard this and told Antonio, so I guess Antonio took off, like, down the hall, and so he told Antonio to come back. Then he ended up walking back over to Sarah and stabbing her in the neck again. However, this time, the knife actually broke off into her neck.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. So Curtis ended up walking back into the kitchen and picked up other knives. So, like, kitchen knives. And came and stabbed her one last time and then tossed her on the bed. And Sarah then decided that she was going to lay there and pretend to be dead. So she's still alive. All the while, while she was laying there on the bed, she heard her little brother Antonio yelling for help. And she looked up and saw Curtis standing over him, and he was stabbing him in the neck. Then Curtis moved on to little Andrew and ended up stabbing him. So he stabbed him in the neck as well. Both Antonio and Andrew's wounds were very similar. So they hit the trachea and some of the main arteries in the neck. So during the time that Curtis's attention was on the 2 boys, Sarah decided it was her time to make a break for it. So she got off the bed and ended up running out of the house, where she made it across the street and hid behind a tree. Now, Curtis followed her outside, but looked around for a little bit and didn't see her, so he ended up going back inside. He checked on everyone and probably believed that they were all dead. However, Regina and baby Andrea were still alive. So Curtis ended up hearing noises and noticed that a neighbor's light had turned on in a house. So he ended up taking off by leaving through a bathroom window. So Sarah didn't know that he had left yet. Mm-hmm. So around 8:30. So this is like less than 30 minutes that this all occurred.
Wow.
I know. So Mrs. Jackson's cousin, who is actually also her next door neighbor, Angelo Geens, was returning home, and Sarah spotted him and ran up to him. So, oh my gosh, could you imagine? She's been stabbed in the neck 4 times and stabbed in the stomach once, like the stomach and chest area. And so I can't even imagine like seeing an 11-year-old running up to me. Like,
yeah.
Oh my gosh. So she ran up to him and told him that Regina and the children were all in the house and that her uncle Curtis had killed them all. Angelo brought her inside and ended up calling 911. When the police arrived on the scene, they discovered the bodies of Shantarika, Dominique, Antonio, and Andrew. All had been stabbed in the neck and all had died from blood loss. So Andrea was stabbed in the neck, but was alive. However, her spinal cord was severed, and so she had limited functions. She's never been able to walk, and she doesn't have any fine motor movements of her arms, so she can't, like, grasp anything with her hands. Regina also survived the 5 stab wounds to her neck and 1 to her stomach, and Sarah survived the 5 stab wounds to her neck, chest, and abdomen. So the wherewithal of, well, first of all, the little baby, just, oh my goodness. And then Regina and Sarah to, like, have the, like, forethought to pretend to be dead. I know we've talked about that in other cases where, you know, I don't know.
It saves lives, yeah. Man. Like, when, especially with things like this, like, obviously, he just was, like, on a rampage. And mm-hmm. he isn't putting in the effort to really make sure that they're dead. So, yeah. I mean, your best chance is to just lay there and hope that he moves on, which he did.
Yeah. And in one of the articles, and I didn't put it in here, there was, one of them, I can't remember who it was, Regina or Sarah, did state that when he was talking about murdering them, that he had apparently come days, like, a couple of times before, and just nobody was home, so he didn't do it. But, like, he had come the Saturday before, and he had planned to murder him, and he'd come the Thursday before that and planned to murder him. So I don't know what's going on. So, it sounds super premeditated because of the fact that he, like, cut the phone line, for one. He parks distance so that he has a getaway vehicle that's not in this area. I mean, so much of it just sounds like he already knew what he brought multiple knives with him, too. So,
yeah, and if they're not home, why wouldn't you just take the safe and go? The freaking safe,
yeah. I don't know. So it doesn't give a lot of, I could not find a lot of information prior to the incident on this family. So it was all very much leading up. And then there's some stuff I'm going to talk about now after, like, the trial and everything. But it doesn't give you a lot of context other than the fact that he was a drug user. But the family seemed like a very, you know, upstanding, went to church, you know, seemed like a very, very loving, supportive family. So I don't know. The police knew who obviously had committed these horrible murders, and a manhunt ensued. So they ended up putting up a whole bunch of roadblocks, and they were able to find the car that he actually fled in, as he left his wallet on the passenger seat. So he fled the car because he actually came across one of the roadblocks, and so he ended up just ditching it and instead hopped a train headed out of town. However, 4 days later, Curtis actually ended up turning himself into the police department. He gave a full confession, stating that he had committed the murders, although in a lot of his testimony and a lot of court cases, because there was many appeals and everything in this case, he says that most of that night is completely blacked out for him.
Okay.
So he was under the influence. I'm pretty sure he was under the influence, and he just does not remember a lot of it. So that's why I'm like, I don't know what was going on with that. So Curtis was indicted for 4 counts of capital murder, 2 counts of aggravated assault, and then armed robbery. Because the deaths were those to minors, it automatically put it up for the death penalty. So Mississippi has laws where if you commit, like, murder against a child, you pretty much are going up for the death penalty. Wow. He pled not guilty to all of the counts. However, he was found guilty and sentenced to death. Curtis was actually set to be put to death by lethal injection on June 6, 2012. However, prior to his execution date, Curtis's whole family, headed up by his sister Regina, asked the governor to give him a reprieve and change the sentence to life in prison. So Regina's the one that he killed her 2 daughters and stabbed her.
Oh, my goodness.
So, Regina has been interviewed a lot, and one of her interviews, she stated, "As a mother who lost 2 babies, all I'm asking is that you not make me go through the killing of my brother. If they kill him, they are doing the exact same thing he did. The dying is going to have to stop somewhere." So, his brother-in-law, the 2 boys were his kids, stated that, "We are not asking you to take pity on Curtis. We are asking you to show us mercy. We have been through enough." So just kind of like the family just didn't want his death. So, yeah. I mean, he's still a family member. I think that the drugs and everything, and they just, you know, had a lot of forgiveness in their hearts, which, you know, I'm not for the death penalty, so we know that. But, like, if anybody killed my nephews, I don't know if I would have that forgiveness in my heart. I don't care if they were related to me or not. Like, I don't know.
But yeah, definitely, like, crimes against a kid, it's just like, mm-hmm. I mean, what do you do in that situation? Like, yeah, you don't want the death penalty, but I mean, I guess it's not like she was saying to pardon him. She was saying like life in prison, because especially too, like an eye for an eye kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, at some point, when is it, how is that honoring the kids, you know?
Yeah. So the governor of Mississippi did not listen to the family's pleas of mercy, and Curtis was put to death on June 6, 2012. He did not give any final words, and he never looked at his family who watched him be put to death. So he didn't acknowledge any of that. Like, and he had remorse. You know, it wasn't like he didn't. Yeah. But yeah, so he just, it's a sad ending all the way around, just especially for this family, because, and I don't know, I think almost it should be up to the victim. No, well, it shouldn't be up to the victim's family. But if they do not want the death penalty as an option, I think that that should be taken off the table. Because even though it's considered a crime against the state, and this, it's, you know, it was Henry Curtis Jackson Jr. versus the state of Mississippi. Really, you know, it's the family that are the victims here. And I just think that should have been taken into account.
Yeah, but then you have to look at it too of like, okay, how far do we go with honoring that? Like, because one, now you're asking a bunch of taxpayers and a bunch of people to continue to pay for this man to be in prison. Mm-hmm. You're asking, like, if you ask, like, for some type of, like, not in this case, but in another case, if you're asking for, like, parole or asking mm-hmm. for them to be freed or things like that, it's like, well, now you're putting the community in danger because you want to see the best in this person or something, you know what I mean? And mm-hmm. then, too, like, life in prison, you are opening up, like, what if he ever escapes, or what if something gets messed up, or what if, like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like, there's just so many what ifs that it's kind of hard to say, like, definitely take it into consideration, but I think Mississippi is definitely not the state to try to, like, say no to the death penalty.
Yeah, definitely not. And that's true. So, but everybody's like, well, you know, it's so much cheaper just to put them to death. And it's like, no, he actually had 22 years worth of appeals that cost, you know, the court process was millions and millions of dollars. So, you know, I'm just like, I mean, it's not necessarily cheaper, but yeah, he was put to death, and this family now grieves the loss of not only their children, but a brother and a son. And so there's no real good ending to this story. I mean, justice was, I guess, found, and they know who did it. But, I mean, it just completely affected one family. And so there was one article where it mentioned that, and maybe this played a part in it, but that, because, you know, you talk about he played sports growing up, and he had a lot of concussions and, like, physical injuries. And so then do you play into the fact that maybe he had some CTE, who knows, and then with drug use, and so you have those two. And, you know, I mean, there have been a lot of other stories of, like, you know, football players going into, like, rages or, like, even committing suicide due to brain injury. And so it was only in one article, which is why I was like, I don't know if I'm going to mention it or not, because you don't know. But it did mention it as, like, a brief history about him in the beginning, is that he did have a lot of, like, physical injuries when he was growing up. So who knows if that played a part in it. And it's not like CTE was around. Well, I guess it was around in 2012, but yeah, it's not something they probably looked for in the autopsy, because why would they? They probably didn't even do an autopsy on him because they know how he died.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that would have been interesting to know if that played a part in it, too. Because that, on top of drug use, like, I mean, how much did the guy have left of, like, his mental capacity to make these kinds of decisions?
Yeah, decisions. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that was my story for this week. Not very uplifting. Pretty damn sad. I did kid dying too. Yours last week was kids dying, or child dying being murdered. Those are always so much harder.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we talked about it last week too. Mm-hmm. It's just like when a child dies, it's like they didn't, like, they made no choices in life. Yeah. Like, they haven't lived anything. They're just put, and especially in, like, this kind of situation, like, we know the kids did literally nothing. It's not like they cried too much or bit him or hit him or did something yeah. that maybe you might be like, okay, I guess.
Yeah. I know. Besides Sarah, none of them seem to have fought back or anything, so.
No, they were all complaining. They were like, cool, take the safe, like, go, yeah. bye. And, like, for him to react in that way was very, it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
But thank you for sharing.
All right, what do we have? What are you sharing this week?
All right, so, little preface of my stuff. So, my story, there was a lot of information, and so it does seem a little bit more well-known than some of the ones that we do, but the reason I chose this was because I did want to discuss social media's role in it, and kind of, there were still injustices that I thought needed to be addressed, and there are some updates recently, so... Okay. This is my story of Jessica Chambers. So Jessica Chambers was what you would consider like an all-American 19-year-old cheerleader from Cortland, Mississippi. She was popular, friendly, and could always be found smiling. She could be stubborn at times and was the kind of person that didn't like being told what to do. So like if you told her to do something, she was going to go the opposite way. She wasn't going to let you dictate to her. Her parents, Ben and Lisa, had divorced when she was just 3 years old, but they seemed to have a pretty good relationship. They actually lived within a few houses of each other, like they lived on the same street. And a lot of my information came from news articles, but there was also, I believe it was an Oxygen special that they did. It's like a 6-episode part. And so I was able to actually like see the parents and they kind of shot like the houses and the streets and stuff. I'm from California where everybody's kind of squished together. Like our streets are very like small when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is like the country, small town Mississippi. So when they say like they lived on the same street, like they kept showing this really long road and I'm like, okay, so they're like,
yeah,
they're a ways. So that was just an interesting thing. So they had divorced when she was 3. They still remain close. Her dad, Ben, had remarried to a woman named Debbie, but they were all still got along. She lived with her mom just a few houses down, and she had 4 siblings. So she had an older brother, Alan, her older sister, AJ, and her younger sister, Annabelle. And I believe they were all the dad's kid, like from her dad's side. I don't know how many of them... I want to say maybe 3 of them were the moms, but the littlest one I don't think is her mom's. I believe that's her dad and Debbie's, because Annabelle is pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
She was close with her family, and she had big dreams for her future. Like I said, she was involved in cheerleading. Growing up, she told her mom like she wanted to be a teacher, or she wanted to write books, or at some point her most recent dream was like being an RN. So she had a lot of stuff that she wanted to do in life. When Jessica was 17, her brother Alan passed away due to a car crash, and this was really hard on her family, but especially on Jessica because they were close. She started to act out, even dropped out of school halfway through her senior year. She started smoking pot and hanging around with, like, gang members. I guess Cortland is, like, pretty heavy on the gang, despite it being a small town of just around 500 people, so... Really small, everybody knows everybody, but they do have, like, gang presence.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this is because of the drugs in the area. So meth, crack cocaine, heroin are huge problems in the town as well, which I think is pretty common along the South, the more that we hear about, like, the opioid crisis and the drug crisis. Like, it's all over. So. Yeah,
absolutely.
So Jessica became immersed in this lifestyle over the next few years, but friends say that by December of 2014, she was really trying to turn her life around. She was talking about going to college, about getting a job, and like I said, she told her mom her dreams of becoming an RN. So on December 6th, 2014, Jessica was hanging out with some friends in the morning before stopping by her mom's house to take a nap. Lisa remembers her coming home around 12:30, 1 p.m., putting on her pajamas and falling asleep in the living room. Sometime in the evening, around 4:45 p.m., Jessica received a text or a phone call, her mom couldn't remember which, and she told her mom that she would be back in a little bit. She was just going to grab some food and then maybe clean out her car a little bit, which is an interesting thing to do at 5 o'clock at night, but hey, you do.
Okay, yeah.
So Jessica leaves and heads to a gas station, like convenience store thing. Because I guess there's only one in this town. Because like I said, super small town.
Yeah.
So she went to this place. It was called the M&M, I believe. And from there, she went to a nearby city called Batesville, which it was unclear really like what she was doing there. And then she headed back to Cortland around 6:30. So she was really only there for a short time. Lisa called to check on Jessica around 6:45, and Jessica told her that she would be home soon, and they each told each other that they loved each other, and they got off the phone. And Lisa remembers that being, like, oddly, like, quiet on the phone. Like, it didn't sound like there was a lot of stuff going on or, like, that the car was moving. Like, you know how you can hear mm-hmm. when someone's driving?
Yeah.
It didn't really sound like that. So, at 8:12 p.m., the volunteer fire department responded to a call about a car fire. As they arrived on scene, they found the car burning on an embankment and Jessica burning on the ground nearby.
Mm.
They rushed to administer first aid, and while she was being treated, they said she was shaking but didn't seem to be in too much pain, which is definitely a warning sign with burns because that means they've gotten so bad yeah. that your body is in shock.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so they ended up asking her, like, who did this to you? Because like I said, small town, volunteer fire department, everybody knows everybody.
Yeah.
And so they were asking her, like, who did this to you? Like, what happened? And she responded with what sounded like the name Eric or Derek. There were different reports that the firefighters had put forth after that. The ambulance arrived pretty quickly and rushed her to the hospital. Around 8:30 p.m., the sheriff called her dad because I guess he worked as a mechanic for the sheriff's department. And so they called him and told him that there's been a fire. He told his wife, Debbie. Debbie ran to the mom's house, told the mom, like, somebody set her on fire. And the mom, Lisa, was in shock because she literally just talked yeah. to her, like, a little bit ago. And she said she was on her way home. So they all rushed to the hospital. It would be discovered that fuel was poured down Jessica's nose and throat, mm-hmm. causing the fire to burn over 93% of her body. From what the family was told, the only part of her body that wasn't burned was the bottom of her feet. So the fire, like I said, I got to watch some of the episodes of that documentary. I didn't watch all six episodes. I'm going to go back and watch them because it was pretty interesting. But the first episode, definitely, if you get a chance to watch it, was very good. It pretty much, like, summarized everything, mm-hmm. and then they were going to get into more details later on about, like, the trial and stuff and things that happened that I'm going to talk about. But, yeah, so the family, like, it was heartbreaking because that volunteer firefighter, he remembers finding her, and he was, like, she just, like, had these red splotchy part, like, you could tell where she was burnt, and he goes, and it was almost like someone put, like, charcoal over her, like, she had all of yeah. the charred pieces.
Oh, God.
And her mom remembers sharing getting to the hospital and she was almost afraid, like she didn't want to see her daughter that way. She goes, but, and I like the quote, she was like, I don't know what they saw, but I just saw my baby girl. Like, that's, she was there. And they showed a picture in the thing. They obviously didn't show her face, but they showed her, she was all bandaged up, like yeah. her whole body, and then they blurred her face, but she was all bandaged up at the hospital. And so Lisa was at Jessica's side in the hospital as doctors informed them that there was nothing else that they could do. And Lisa told Jessica that it was okay and that she could let go, and held Jessica's hand as she took her last breath in the early morning hours of December 7th. And that was also the thing, is it was heartbreaking to hear her mom, Lisa, say that she almost has this sense of guilt for telling her to let go. But then at the same time, she was like, it would have been unfair of me to ask her to keep fighting and like yeah. to have her stay here in that much pain. Because I don't know if any of you have ever seen or heard of like burn victim. It is terrible.
Yeah.
And there and is
the chances of survival with that many, because I'm sure they were all third degree burns. And so like in over 93% of your body, it's going to move to infection. There's just no way.
Yeah. And like with burn, like as far as technology has come, even with burn victims, the chances are very low because mm-hmm. your body goes into shock and like mm-hmm. it just, I mean, I think a lot of them end up dying of like heart attacks and yeah. things, like because their body just can't handle the pain of having to like be bandaged and taking yeah. the bandages off and all of that.
All it's your just nerve endings are exposed and mm-hmm. yeah, what a horrible, yeah. horrible thing to have happen very to anybody. Horrible way to go.
Yeah. So police launched a full-scale investigation into what happened, and 2 days later had created a special task force to figure out what caused all of this. Nobody in the town really knew who could have been capable of this.
Yeah, because of Town of 500, you're like, I mean, you're running through everybody because you know everybody.
Yeah.
And so you're like, okay, mm-hmm. Oh, man. And just like even like the speculation, oh, I'm sure that hurt some people.
Yeah. And the dad said that he basically couldn't trust anybody at that point because you don't know. Like, who do you trust at that point? Especially because she didn't really seem to have made enemies.
Yeah.
She seemed pretty friendly and outgoing. Yeah, she was kind of getting into trouble, but not to the point where that would be relevant. But we're going to talk about kind of the speculation. As search for any type of evidence took place at the scene, because everything was burnt, so they had to kind of wait and find what they could, police began to try to locate this Eric or Derek person. So the town was on edge as everybody with those names was questioned. And so they showed it, like, news clips of people whose names just happened to be Eric or Derek and Mike. Because, again, a town where everybody knows everybody, you're going to associate with every single person in town, pretty much.
Yeah, and how many Erics and Derics? But how many Erics and Derics could there possibly be in a town of 500?
I want to say in those first couple of days when that was the only thing they were going off of, they interviewed around 30 suspects.
Oh, shit. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's way more than I thought.
Well, it's a... Eric and Derek are both common, like, African-American and white names.
That's
and
true.
This is what it, this town is.
Yeah, that is true.
So Jessica's sister, AJ, started a Facebook group called Justice for Jessica to try to help find who had done this to her sister. And basically, like, a place for people to, like, share memories and things like that. This created a huge social media frenzy as people from all over started to hear about what happened and put in their two cents. This caught the attention of an investigative reporter at BuzzFeed News, and she said it caught her attention due to the actual way, like, the fact that she was burned alive. It's such a personal way to kill someone that caught her attention. But not only that, and this was something I disagreed with, I didn't like that she said this in the documentary, but she said that it was an intriguing story because Jessica was a young, beautiful, blonde cheerleader. And I know we talk about this over and over and over. It's like, these are not the only victim. Like, yes, this is a tragedy. Definitely. Yeah. We're talking about it.
Yeah.
And it deserves to be talked about. But it almost exposes, like, that the media is choosing these victims because they're young, because they're beautiful, because they're blonde, and because they fit that archetype of, like, a cheerleader or, like, a really feminine woman. And it's just like, okay. Anyway, but that's what she said. So she started investigating more of, like, what this is doing to the town.
Yeah.
And so social media took a hold on it. And like with most things, people started chiming in. Who did they think did it? What did they think was going on? They were coming up with rumors of their own. And rumors can be very dangerous.
Oh my gosh, so, yeah. I can't even imagine. And especially in a small town. Oh my God.
Yes. And not only that, these are people chiming in from their couch in, like, Canada and California and Florida. And, like, places aren't even, they have nothing to do with this.
Yeah. It's like, don't F with cats. Like, that documentary. Oh, yeah. everybody and their horse on the internet is just, like, freaking speculating.
Yeah, and in some instances, that's helpful, and in some instances, it's definitely not.
Yeah.
And so, rumors grew, and I'm going to share a couple of the main rumors that were talked about. Some thought it was a gang retaliation crime, so because she had some affiliation that, oh, it must have been gang-related, like, this was payback for something. Another rumor was that her dad did it because he didn't like her dating black guys, because that was, a lot of her ex-boyfriends were African-American.
Okay.
That her boyfriend, who I couldn't really get a read on if he was a current boyfriend or a recent ex-boyfriend, but he was in prison, so they were saying that he must have put a hit out on her because he thought that she was cheating on him. Another rumor was that her mom might have been a drug user because her dad had a past history with drugs. And so somehow, like, they
those
were
go hand
just
in
really,
hand.
Yeah, so either they were just really shitty parents or that they might have had something to do with it. And then another popular theory was that the black people in the area did it because she was white. So then it became this huge race thing.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Because in the town of Cortland, predominantly, it's African American. Mm-hmm. But it's these are just people. So everything got turned into a race thing online. And so it became this huge stuff. So those that were close to Jessica were hurt by the rumors and quick to shoot them down. Police also paid little mind, as they had already looked into a lot of these angles that the would-be social media sleuth had suggested. So then it became kind of, and I did like that they talked about this, of like, yeah, we appreciate the input, but it's not that the cops aren't looking into these things. They're just not sharing with you, specifically person in another country, like what it is that's going on at every step of the way.
Because it's not your business. And they also can't share, because like that can affect the investigation and then the ability to prosecute.
Yeah. So just some of the ways that they shut it down. So the police did look into the gang situation because there were the loose ties. Her boyfriend had been affiliated with the gang, the one that was in prison, but there was no evidence of that. And they even had like informant, like the gangs in the area were actually helping the police, like try to find out who did this. So they were actually being helpful and like, well, probably
they, and they don't want that kind of spotlight on them either. So it's like,
yeah,
let's solve this.
Yeah, let's do it. So they didn't have anything to do with it. They also, there was no evidence that a boy that was in prison had anything to do with it. Even to the actual mainstream media, so not just social media, but news outlets had actually put a picture of her ex-boyfriend on the screen. So then it led social media people to try to crucify her ex-boyfriend. And so they actually talked to his mom on there. He was like, he wasn't even in, I think he was in a different state at the time. Like, he wasn't around. He had an alibi and he was really hurt. They had a volatile relationship, but in the end, like, they just had broken up. Like, it didn't, it wasn't that. Like, what would have been the point of that? So it was just a whole lot of speculation that was kind of slowing down the police investigation of stuff. And so Jessica's father did have a past history of drug use and even had spent time in prison for possession and intent to manufacture meth. But again, like, the sheriffs knew him. He had an alibi. Like, obviously, like, in a lot of these cases, they look at the parents, then they look at people close. Like, they check all these boxes pretty quickly. Also, like, he was at home when the sheriff called him.
Yeah, and what the hell would be the motive? I still don't understand the motive. So what if he had drug history? Like, what the fuck, like, besides, like, my daughter's dating black guys, like, what in the hell motivation was there to do that? Like, yes. That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, like, why is he going to kill her for drugs? Like, that doesn't, it doesn't bode well. Anyway, so Ben Chambers was also in the episode. He took offense to the rumors that he was racist, claiming that, like, he had black and Mexican friends, which, one, I never liked that argument of like, no, I can't be racist because I have friends that are minorities. Like, that's not true at all. You can totally be racist.
Yeah.
But
oh yeah,
but he did admit like that he didn't believe in interracial relationships because that's how he was raised, because Mississippi, like, that's how he was raised, to not believe. He goes, so he didn't think it was okay, but he also didn't hold that against his daughter. Like, it never seemed like their relationship didn't seem strained at all because of it. He kind of let her make her choices, I guess. Maybe he thought down the line they would talk about it, but it didn't seem to affect him in this moment. Plus, she lived with her mom, so he might not have really even known who she was dating at what
point. Oh, I'm sure he did. It's a small town. He knew.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I always forget. It's a small town.
It's a small town. That man knew. He knew when she was sneezing, when she was pooping, like, if she looked at somebody weird. It's just the way small towns are.
They did question, like, there was this other person in the area, a drug, I didn't get his name, but he had something to do with, like, the drug aspect, and the dad knew that, like, she had pissed this guy off in the community, he was a white guy, and that the guy had actually threatened to kill her.
Oh.
But guy had an alibi, he totally checked out, and then he ended up dying at some point after that because he was, like, super on drugs a lot, and it killed him. So that also, the police looked into that, and that also didn't pan out. So
that's crazy that she had somebody that actually threatened to kill her, and then that's not the person who killed her. Like, what?
No, I know. But it was kind of more like, when you think about it, though, like, if you get into arguments with people, at some point someone might say something like that, or, like, threaten to beat you up or threaten to hurt you in some way. Like, so it sounded kind of more like that, not like he was, like, specifically, like, I'm going to come get you. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but either way, he had an alibi, and it didn't seem like he did it. So over time, police interviewed over 100 different suspects, and they were still no closer to solving this case than when they started. Needing more to go on, the police offered a reward that started at $10,000 and ended up growing over time as they weren't getting information to, I believe the final reward offered was like $54,000. But again, small town, nobody wants to like snitch on anybody or like look like maybe they gave wrong information or turned people against them, so people weren't reporting anything. Finally, they ended up getting surveillance footage from that gas station convenience store parking lot, and police were able to see Jessica before she died and began to interview everyone that was around that convenience store that evening. So even, I think they were just looking for anyone who was there before, after, yeah, around that time that was there. And this led them to George Mister. George claimed that he and Jessica were friends, and she would even sometimes sleep on his couch when she needed a place to crash. He thought she was an all right person. I think drugs were their main connection, because George did have a criminal past, like he had been in jail for a while, like drug charges, things like that. But overall, he cooperated with the police and told them, like, yeah, I saw her that morning, but I didn't see her again. I don't know what happened.
And he's from that same small town?
Yes. I believe he had something, I don't know, the connection was kind of loose about how they led to him. I think he happened to be at the convenience store at some point that day, and so they questioned him. But he told them he hadn't seen her since that morning because she had gone over and she had crystal meth on her and wanted to trade it for cocaine, is what he said. But he said, no, I don't have any of that. So then she took off and he didn't see her again. Because remember, she was like with friends or wherever she was that morning before she got to her mom's. So we don't really know what she was doing. But apparently she was trying to trade drugs. He didn't have any. Sent her on her way. He didn't really run into her the rest of the day. I think he said he saw her later on in the town, mm-hmm, but like not interacted with her at all. Meanwhile, while they were looking into George, social media was quick to crucify the clerk at the gas station who turned in the surveillance tape, claiming that he looked like a terrorist, so he must have had something to do with Jessica's murder.
Oh no, and because is he white or no?
No, I think he was, I couldn't really tell if he was like Middle Eastern, Hispanic,
okay,
African American. I don't know. He definitely was a minority.
Okay.
I couldn't really tell.
Because I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, but I think it was because he had, like, pictures that surfaced. I don't know if they were Facebook pictures or whatever. He was holding a gun, like a machine gun. But then, again, I'm like,
that's Mississippi.
Mississippi.
And like, he's a convenience store clerk, and it sounds like not the most upscale town.
Like, he's just,
I mean, they got gangs and drugs and everything. Maybe he just needs to protect himself.
Yeah. So then on the news footage, they were like, did you have anything to do with it? And he was like, no, I just gave them the footage. Like, just here, like, take it. So,
because
social media is going on a rampage.
They're just grasping at any straw. Yep. Just like, okay, here are my conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that so true of the internet?
Oh, yeah.
So Jessica's family was losing confidence as time went by and there were still no arrests. As police kept running into dead ends, they were finally able to get Jessica's cell phone records and track her location the day of her murder. Because the whole time they were trying to retrace her steps with everything. And this is where I'm not clear on, like, what the timeline of everything is, because this was just, people were just giving me information of stuff, yeah, and it wasn't really a whole timeline. So I don't know if this happened pretty soon after she died or if they had to wait some time, but on her phone, they found multiple texts and calls from 27-year-old Quentin Tellis. Tellis's family and some of Jessica's friends claimed that the two were friends after meeting 2 weeks before her death, just after Tellis had been released from prison on burglary charges. And so this dude had a criminal history, things like a DUI, burglary, grand larceny. What was the other one? There was another charge that was on there. Robbery, I think. Because I think there's a difference between robbery and burglary.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had a couple of those charges. So he was kind of in and out of prison and had some different charges. But anyway, they met. They became friends. Her friends even said, like, yeah, we remember hearing about him. She just said he was quiet. He was nice. And then his family was on the documentary as well. And they say that, like, he was, like, that shoulder to cry on for her, like, when she had issues with, like, her family and stuff like that.
After 2 weeks of knowing her?
I guess.
Dang.
But they also lived near each other. He lived, like, at the end of the street. Again, not, like, a typical street, but, like, a really long road.
Mm-hmm.
In their text exchanges, investigators discovered that Jessica had denied Tellis's request for sex 4 times on the day of her murder. So he was shooting his shot a lot that day. Because I feel like, dude, she told you no the first time. Which is also a weird thing. What are you saying to her? Like, they never told me what the text messages were, but I'm like, does he just, like, text, like, hey, you want to come over and have sex? Like, how is he approaching this 4 separate times in one day, mind you?
Dang.
I was like, and during the day, because, like, obviously, like, something happened to her sometime around 8 o'clock, so that's not even, like, a whole 24 hours, and you tried 4 times to get her to sleep with you. That's, no. Guys.
No.
If a woman tells you no, she legit means no.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't want to.
No.
She's not going to change her mind in a few hours, a few minutes, whatever, however long you waited. Just, no. If she wants to, she will let you know.
Yep. She'll reach out. She'll ask.
Yeah. She'll ask because you've already told her you're interested.
Yeah.
She'll reach out if she wants to later on because she knows.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Just a public service announcement there.
Yeah. Like, the more you know.
Yeah. Another more you know situation. Jesus.
Yeah. So Tellis had been questioned initially, because it sounds like they pretty much questioned anybody who had any connection with her at all or was in the town.
At this point, the police were like, grasping. Let's ask everybody in the whole town and the neighboring towns, and like the entire county is getting asked by this point.
Yeah. So he had been questioned, taken a polygraph, passed the polygraph, and given the police an alibi. But in addition to the text messages, police also found that Tellis's phone was pinging off of the same towers as Jessica's way past the times he previously stated that he was with her. Because his initial statement was that he was only with her in the morning. But then they started seeing that his phone was pinging off of towers into the afternoon and evening. So his alibi is not checking out so much.
But how many... I question the cell phone tower pinging just because if one is, like, I think, well, I don't know, in the case of Adnan Syed, like, if you know, that's how he got convicted was that, and that turned out that's some bullshit stuff there, but that was from the 90s. But nowadays, even now, what if, like, that tower is full, it pings you to the next closest tower, and how many towers are in this small town? I mean, I know from Nebraska, there aren't that many, and so you have shitty service until you finally get close to a tower, and then it picks up for that. So you could be miles and miles away.
So I think for this one, it would have been within 200 yards. And so they narrowed it down pretty quickly, like, was my guess. But there's other stuff, so we'll get to what else they found. So
what?
That's what they said. What? In addition.
Okay. I mean, I'm not a guru knowledgeable about cell phone towers, but I just wonder how many cell phone towers were around. Like, I don't know. I don't know. Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
Police finally had a link that they could use to set out to question Tellis again. But this led them to the discovery. And so this is where I'm not sure how much time was happening in between these things, how long it took to get the cell phone records, because they didn't go out to try to question him again until the end of 2015, beginning of 2016. So it had been some time.
Years.
So I don't know. Well, this happened in the end of 2014. So December of 2014.
Yeah. So at least over a year.
Yeah. So that's why I'm not 100% sure on what the timeline was or what roadblocks they hit. Because I do know it might be kind of difficult to get certain phone records.
Oh, yeah.
Cell phone tower things, all of that. Plus, they were still looking at trying to find evidence in the car. They found her cell phone away from the car. They found her car keys even further away from the car. So they were trying to find different things. So maybe they were trying to build up
the case,
as much of the case as they could. When they were looking for Tellis to question him again, they discovered that he was already in prison in Louisiana in connection with another murder.
Oh, shit.
So I'm going to briefly tell you about that. I'm not going to go into this whole story, but in 2015, Ming Chen Xiao, I think is how you pronounce her last name, but she went by Mandy. She was an exchange student from Taiwan, and she was found murdered in her apartment just 8 months after Jessica's murder. Tellis was seen at Mandy's apartment 2 weeks before her murder and was asking suspicious questions of one of her neighbors because she lived in like this apartment complex near the college that she was attending or that she had just graduated from, I believe. I don't think, I can't remember what the specifics were of that, but he showed up a few weeks before she was murdered and was asking, like, one of her neighbors, like, when is she going to be home and where's she at? And, like, asking weird questions about her. And her neighbor was kind of like, this dude is, there's something not right about this. Mm-hmm. Like, she just felt off about it. And then they ended up finding her because neighbors called and said that there was a smell coming from her apartment. And so that's when the police were called and they found her.
Oh, jeez.
And it was shown that she had, like, stab wounds, and I think they describe them as shallow, indicating that it was more of like a torture thing. It was not a quick death for her.
Mm-hmm.
And Tellis was caught using Mandy's card at an ATM, and calls placed him within 200 yards of her apartment at the time of her death. That's where I got the 200 yards from.
Okay.
So that's how they're narrowing it. So yeah. I think that's where the phone pings, is that's the radius that it...
Yeah, and maybe because Google Maps and, like, our phones can tell, like, Apple can tell who we've been in contact with for COVID. So,
mm-hmm.
So I guess, man, yeah.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, the police didn't have any DNA evidence that could charge him for her murder. So they only were able to charge him for using her credit card and withdrawing. Like, he tried to withdraw, like, $1,000 or something.
Oh.
And so they were able to charge with unauthorized use of the card. And he was sentenced to 10 years, which seems very excessive for that. But I'm wondering if it's because he had prior...
Yeah, I was, like, just going to say, I bet he has...
burglary,
yeah.
Robbery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they still considered him a suspect for the murder, but for now, at least they put him in jail for the credit card thing.
Yeah.
So police from Mississippi questioned Tellis in the prison in Louisiana, and he adamantly denied his involvement in Jessica's murder, saying he doesn't have it in his heart to murder anybody.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But you pretty much are probably the one that murdered Mandy. Okay.
Yeah. And he was also denying that.
Of course he is.
So his story was, like I said, first that he had only seen her in that morning. Then after they were like, he tried to say that his alibi for the original one was that he was in Batesville around the time that she was killed. So at like 8:26, security footage placed him there. So that was more than 15 minutes after the fire was found. But I don't think they could rule that as a complete alibi because I believe the towns are pretty close to each other. It's almost like, I think, Fresno, Clovis, kind of.
Oh, okay.
Like they're real close to each other.
Yeah.
So I don't think that was something, because they never said, like, oh, there's no way he could have gotten there
mm-hmm.
15 minutes after the call was played. Like, there was no way. It seemed in the realm that they could have done that. So, still, after the phone records proved that he was near her again, he ended up changing his story, saying, yeah, no, actually, I was with her until 7 p.m., and then a friend came and picked me up, and I don't know where she went. And so police, of course, decided to check that alibi, talk to his friend, and his friend was like, nope, I was at a football game in Nashville. I could prove it. No way I could have picked him up. And so, which I'm like, dude, you got to get better friends if that's
yeah.
what you're doing. They're like, my hands are tied. I wasn't anywhere near him. Which, arguably, though, is what you should do if your friend is asking you to lie because they murdered somebody.
Yes.
So, Tellis then changed his story again and was like, okay, no, Jessica picked me up. And then we went to Taco Bell in Batesville. And then we went back to my house, which, again, was just down the street from Jessica's, which does check out enough for the fact that they didn't know she had gone to Batesville for, like,
yeah.
30-ish minutes and come back. So that could check out, like, that that's what happened. And that they stayed in his driveway listening to music for a while. And then Jessica left at 7 p.m. Again, they checked it with the phone records and the surveillance video from the gas station to prove that she didn't leave his house until 7:30. So why is he lying about those 30 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
And then she ended up in the embankment that she would be found at. And so police ended up taking Tellis's DNA and they matched it to the DNA found on Jessica's car keys that were found between the crime scene and his sister's house. They were found on this, like, pathway. Because I think they're, again, small town. I think everyone's kind of in the same vicinity. His sister's house was, I believe, in between the crime scene. And I think his house was somewhere also.
Well, didn't you say this town was, like, ridiculously small? Like,
yeah, so looking up the town, I think they were, like, a square foot or, like, 1.1 square feet or so. I don't know.
Miles?
It's, like, a really... Miles, yes.
One square foot.
Square feet. It's just a little square foot. No, miles.
Yeah. So, like, nobody can live too far from... I mean, that's, like, a 5-minute walk.
Yeah. Okay, so they took his DNA. They found it on the keys. Mm-hmm. It was also discovered that within an hour of Jessica's death, all communications between the two were deleted from Tellis's phone. And he had stopped texting to check in with her despite being in contact with her literally all day. He had been texting to check in.
And obviously asking her again for some sex.
So immediately that ceased after she left, which was kind of not the norm because he had been doing that. And then for 2 weeks, they had been in pretty constant contact.
Yeah.
Prosecutors believe that Tellis tried to have sex with Jessica in the driveway. And when she refused, he got really mad. And he suffocated her until she passed out. Then he drove her car to the embankment. Because they kept bringing up in the documentary, like, how, like, they got the car so close to the embankment. It just didn't make sense, like, on that little hill thing that she was at. Like, why she would have pulled up there or pit there. Because they also ruled out, like, that it was an accident or, like, she, like, crashed and set the car on fire and things like that. So it was just a really weird place to park. So they believe that he parked the car there with her in it. Ran to his sister's house nearby, took her car, drove to his house, picked up gasoline at his house, so like one of those gas canister things, and returned to Jessica's car, dumped gasoline all over the car and her, and set it on fire with her inside. And then drove the sister car, got away, distanced himself from the what happened.
Not saying that that couldn't happen, but... Also, how would he know that she would have stayed unconscious for that amount of time?
I don't know. So in a few of the articles, it said that she was suffocated. In other instances, it said that he might have bashed her head in a little bit. So, like bumped her head. So then maybe that's why he thought. And also, too, it doesn't really say if he knew she was alive. Oh, okay. So, like, maybe,
maybe he thought she that she dead.
Killed her and was just like, I'm just going to burn it all up. And, like, maybe they'll think it's an accident or something. I don't know. So, yeah, it never really says that he thought she was still alive. Because, remember, she's denying the whole thing, so we really don't know what his thought process was. So, Tellis was indicted in February of 2016 of capital murder, and the trial was set to take place on October 10th, 2017, in a town that was 250 miles away. Because, again, small town.
Yeah.
Everyone's heard all of these crazy things.
Yeah, you can't, so you can't drive around away. That. Yeah, not even in that county.
Yeah, so they went to a whole other county.
Yeah.
So defense argued that the police should be looking for this Eric or Derek person and that they just wanted to pin the crime on somebody. And doctors and other experts testified that due to her injuries, it would have been very difficult for her to speak. And that even though it might have sounded like that's what she said, there's no way to really know that's what she said. Especially, too, like you think about it. Her voice would have been very raspy and hard, like she might have been speaking quietly. The defense tried to say, well, all their reports were the same and consistent, but they all legit could have thought they heard her say that, and that could have not been what or she
they
was saying.
Or they could have talked about it and been like, did you hear Eric or Derek? And he would have been like,
yeah,
maybe not, say, oh, but did yeah, you hear okay, her say yeah.
Eric? And then they start hearing that's what they sounded like. Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also, phone records proved that she had no contact with anybody by any of those names in the last 30 days. So it would have been highly unlikely that in the 30 minutes or whatever that she left his house, that she ran into literally anybody else that would have wanted to. Just, what, you run into someone and they immediately want to set you on fire? Like, that doesn't really track as well. But, girl, rejecting you four times over text message and once in person might... be a little bit more of a motive.
Yeah. But that's still a lot of circumstantial evidence, you know. And he did say he had been with her that day, so he could have touched her keys. I don't know what DNA was on her keys, but, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, also, too, I forgot to mention, Mississippi law dictates that they couldn't share any of the other, about the other murder or anything to do with that or say that, like, he was a part of another murder trial
because he's not been convicted of it. It's just he's suspected. He's a person of interest.
Mm-hmm, so they couldn't bring anything up that had to do with Louisiana. So 7 days after the trial started, the jury couldn't reach a unanimous verdict and expressed confusion after giving a not guilty verdict and not understanding what unanimous meant. So, like, I think... So, basically, they couldn't... Which for anyone, unanimous means that everybody agrees.
But I don't want to be, like, really condescending, but does that not... Isn't Mississippi one of the worst educated, like I believe has so. The best worst education system in our country?
It does. I think they were just super confused in terms of the way they... Because I looked up, like, what it was they were confused about, and I think... They understood that it had to be unanimous for a guilty verdict, but didn't understand that it had to be unanimous for a not guilty verdict. And so they weren't unanimous on not guilty. And so they had to, because they had said they found him not guilty, that wasn't true because they weren't unanimous on it.
Yeah.
And so they had to declare a mistrial.
Okay.
And so the following year in September, the case was retried, same court, same judge, and on October 1st, 2018, a second mistrial was declared after the jury was, again, unable to reach a unanimous verdict. So Tellis was returned to Louisiana because at that point, they were ready to charge him with murder in Mandy's death.
Okay.
And so he's currently awaiting trial for that. His next court date, because from what I could read or what I could find recently, like to give you an update on what's going on with that, is that they set bail for him or like of, I can't remember, I think it was like $300,000 or something like that.
But how could he even have bail? Because shouldn't he still be in prison for the using of her ATM card?
I don't know. I couldn't find anything about that. I think they might have like, he qualified for something or they reduced his sentence. I have no idea what happened with the credit card thing. But anyway, bail. Okay. And then his lawyer was trying to get bail reduced to $25,000 instead of $300,000 because he needs to be able to be released so he could help work on his defense and like do that kind of. And I'm like, that's weird. But
that's the dumbest. No, that's a lame excuse.
I know. So I couldn't find anything that said that had gone through, but I think that might be what the next court date in April is for. To figure out that maybe, or just to start the trial. It wasn't really clear on what I could find. And so everything's still waiting on that right now. But I did read something that said that even if he gets released from jail, he's not allowed to leave jail because Mississippi still has a hold on him. And they're like, nope, he stays, which also doesn't really make sense to me. But I'm not 100% clear on the law. So if you understand that, email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com and tell me what that means. But it looked like Mississippi still has a hold on him in some way. And so he has to stay in jail for something.
Well, because if they're going to, because I'm guessing it's because, like, you know how if you're not given bail or you can't make bail, you have to stay in prison until your end of your trial. Maybe that's the case. So maybe they're going to retry him again because there's a mistrial. So that could possibly be it.
Yeah. So I think they're holding on. They're trying to do that. Because in the second retrial, they did bring about some evidence. Somebody who I believe was distantly related to him, not to her. Even though her last name didn't have to do with Chambers. It was somehow she was like related to him. Did mention seeing another man around who was also in his 20s and was African-American. They testified at the trial, but it didn't really obviously seem to make a difference because they were still undecided. They were still not unanimous. So who knows what evidence they'd bring for a third one, if any new evidence, or if they would just keep presenting it till someone can decide what's going on. But
I wonder if they can keep retrying it and just get mistrial after mistrial after mistrial. Like, can you just keep trying it until you get a verdict?
That I don't know. I didn't look up how many mistrials. Like, is it like a three and out kind of thing? Like, I don't know.
Because, I mean, if it's just the evidence that you said that they had, like, that, I don't know. I don't know if that's enough for me. I don't know if I would have been able to say he's guilty either. Because it's like just that, I don't know.
Yeah, so it looks like there's no limit. A mistrial means there's no verdict, so until the prosecutor decides to stop trying the case, they can keep going for as long as
so then just to. Keep trying it and keep him in prison.
Basically. Shit. So, I don't know.
If you were innocent and that kept happening, that would fucking suck.
But that's where it's like on your lawyers and to try to figure out, like, you got to present new evidence and you got to prove, like, till you get them to vote not guilty. But
it has to be so hard in Mississippi not to get somebody that has not heard about this case. You know what I mean? It's like, Oh, man.
And even now, in the documentary they shared, I don't remember seeing this, but apparently Jessica was on People magazine when the case first happened. It's, again, like, everybody's very involved and interested. BuzzFeed took a hold of it, but you don't really hear about it anymore. I don't remember this case. And so definitely something where it's, unfortunately, the family still doesn't have answers. They still don't have justice. Everybody believes that it's him, with the exception of his family, but there's nothing they can really do. So they're just going to keep trying, I guess. They didn't really say. I think they're waiting to find out what happens in
Louisiana.
So if I get an update, I'll let you guys know. But that was the story of Jessica. And it's just really unfortunate that her family doesn't get any kind of closure with it. As is true for, I think, a lot of the cases when they don't know, or like the killer gets away. It's like the family just has to live with that. And it's just, it's rough. Such a horrific way to go.
That has to be so hard on the jury, too, because such a horrific way to die. Like, do you lean towards, could have done it. Like, there's opportunity there, but is there enough actual evidence? I don't know. That's so hard. Like, because it's not like... people saw him do it, or besides the DNA on her, his DNA was on her, found on her. It's just the keys. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. And even with the phone records, that's only like, I mean, that's hella suspicious. Like, to me, that's enough of it. It's like, okay, she kept rejecting this dude. He kept trying. And apparently she went to go get food with him at some point. His story is changing, which is really weird.
Yeah.
And which, again, kind of like, even though the defense kept bringing up the polygraph test, it's like, well, obviously that wasn't true. Like, he just told that he lied and this is a new story. So that polygraph that he passed, which is why I'm not a huge fan of polygraphs.
They're not even admissible in court, so who gives a shit about him passing or not passing a polygraph? It doesn't even matter.
No, and polygraphs are so easy to cheat for a lot of people anyway that they're not an accurate representation.
What if he's a sociopath? Like, their bodies don't respond. Polygraphs are stupid.
Yeah, or even too, like, sometimes when they interview people, if you're under a high stress situation, it's gonna look like you're lying because you're just stressed. I feel like I would fail a polygraph answering my own name because I'd just be so like, nervous that I'm lying.
That sounds weird. No, is that right? Do you ever have that sometimes, like, where you hear your name or your name is in your head and you're like, is that my name? That sounds weird. I have that sometimes. I don't know why.
Yeah, I have that with, like, a lot of words sometimes where I'm like, did I say that right? Like, is that how you say that word? Yeah. But, no, definitely, it's just really rough that they're Jessica's family. They still have no justice for her, and you still don't know. And
yeah. Well, hopefully they will, and hopefully they do have the right guy, and maybe some new evidence will present itself, or you never know. But,
yeah. So that was the story of Jessica Chambers.
Thank you for sharing that.
So now it is time for our super fun state facts.
And cities.
All right. I think I started last week.
Okay, sure.
Pumpkins, you want to go ahead and start?
Okay. So as I mentioned before, my murder happened in Greenwood. And apparently Greenwood is the home of the Blues Heritage Museum and Gallery. And they celebrate the life and music of Robert Johnson. Now, I am not, nor do I pretend to have any sort of knowledge on blues music and even the subgenre of Delta blues music. But he apparently is a bigwig in that. So Robert Johnson is considered the godfather of Delta blues music. So he was around in the 1930s. Anyway, legend says that he sold his soul to the devil in order to become the greatest guitar man ever. So I'm wondering, have you ever seen O Brother, Where Art Thou? And there's the guy that walks with him, the black guy that's walking with him that wants to play the guitar. I'm betting it's based off of this guy.
Oh, okay.
I don't know but just when I was reading that, I was like, that story sounds super familiar to me. So anyway, so Johnson, because, you know, we like to talk about murder on this podcast. So Johnson died under very mysterious circumstances. He was found dead on a back road. No cause of death was ever given. He actually died on August 16th, 1938. But the legend goes that, well, some people say that he died of syphilis, but who knows? But that's not as good a story. So dying of syphilis, sorry. But the legend goes that he was murdered because he was flirting with a lady and her husband became insanely jealous. And so he ended up poisoning Robert Johnson's whiskey. And that's how he died. But the sad fact is that a black man was found dead on the road in Mississippi in the 1930s and nobody gave a shit to investigate.
Damn.
So.
What the fuck, Mississippi? Get your shit together.
So, but he's very much celebrated as the godfather of Delta blues music. So he has a whole kind of museum. He died. He wasn't born in Greenwood, but he died in Greenwood. So.
Okay. All right. So I had a super tiny town, as we have discussed. So I couldn't find anything for Cortland, but we did find something for Batesville, which is the city next to it. So Batesville has these mounds, which is a Mississippi landmark, and it's been described as one of the most important prehistoric ceremonial sites in Mississippi. They were believed to be inhabited by the early to middle woodland Indians between 500 BCE and 100 CE. And so the ancient Native Americans seem to have lived at the North and South Village sites and used the six mounds, which are A, B, C, D, E, and the McCarter Mound to the north for ceremonial purposes. So what you could do at this site is you could view the mounds, with Mound C being the best preserved one, and Mound B, which is a rectangular platform mound, being also a well-preserved one. There's trails that have been paved, which apparently was due to the hard work of the Boy Scout troop of Panola County. So putting the kids to work.
Way to go, Boy Scouts.
Yeah. So there's wildlife around, and there's like a park. So there's like trains nearby and things like that. So lots of stuff to do there. So yeah, so that was Batesville. They have these pretty cool mounds, which I'm sure is exciting to people.
I mean, if I was around that area, I'd go check that out. I think that's interesting. So
I'd want to know more about, like, the history stuff, not necessarily to go see the mound, but, like,
yeah,
I'd want, like, a visitor center where I can learn about why, like, they believe
what they were there for. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Like, what were the ceremonies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, so I'm giving you guys the super fun state fact for Mississippi. And so there are certain states that I like to shout out first for giving us usually a very sexy man. So
who's from Mississippi?
So we have Mississippi to thank for birthing my favorite singer of all times. He is from Tupelo, Mississippi. Do you know who it is?
I don't.
Elvis Presley.
Elvis.
Yeah.
I thought he was from Graceland. Or is
where Graceland is, you know, where he lived in Tennessee. But no, he was actually born in Mississippi. So thank you, Mississippi. Cause I love me some Elvis Presley. So yeah. But that's not my fun fact. That's just me thanking Mississippi for giving birth to that. hunka burning love. So the interesting Mississippi state fact I'm going to give you is that the oldest field game in America is stickball. So not baseball. So I'm guessing baseball is probably based off of this. But stickball was played by the Choctaw Indians of Mississippi since 1729. And apparently they still hold the Stickball World Series. It's hosted in Mississippi by the Choctaw, usually in Philadelphia, Mississippi, every July. And it is apparently arguably the biggest and most hotly contested indigenous ball game in the country. So I think that'd be kind of cool to go see. Like, you don't even like baseball, but like, I love baseball.
No, but it'd be interesting to see, like, I don't know, it's just different.
Yeah. So, and who knew? I had no idea that they had their own World Series for stickball. So, and is stickball, I don't know if that's like baseball or lacrosse. Because isn't lacrosse kind of based off of a Native American game, too?
I don't know.
So maybe it's one or the other. But I just assume stickball, because when we played stickball when I was young, we would have a ball and we'd pick up a stick. Because we didn't have a baseball bat.
Yep.
So that's what I'm going to consider it, because I didn't do my research on what exactly stickball is. I just saw that fact and I thought it was cool.
Yeah, definitely. Also, because Amber brought up Elvis Presley, fun fact about her, she can't listen to other Elvis impersonators. She has not seen Lilo and Stitch, guys, because they impersonate Elvis. This animated thing lip syncs to Elvis Presley, the Elvis Presley, and she cannot watch it. And that is a travesty, because Lilo and Stitch is amazing.
That is absolutely 100% true.
Yes. I was surprised that you were okay with me having my wedding song be a cover of I wasn't Falling in Love With You.
Yeah, no, I wasn't thrilled about it being a cover, but it was your wedding. I wasn't going to be like, Selena, listen to the best version of it, not your shitty version.
My version wasn't shitty. It was good. I liked it. It was fun. Anyways, you should watch Lilo and Stitch because it's an amazing movie. And
I won't. I'm not going to do it. I have boycotted
it. They're lip syncing. It's not even a cover. They're lip syncing. It's an animated alien.
Most Elvis impersonators lip sync to Elvis. They don't just... Some sing, but not a lot of them. I just have an aversion to it. I don't know why. It's very strict. I just do. Like, I hate going to Las Vegas because there's so many goddamn Elvis impersonators. It fucking annoys me.
Oh, that's hilarious.
But I don't have any other problem with any other impersonator. Like, you can impersonate anybody else in the world. I do not care. Just not Elvis. Think it's cool, but just not Elvis.
All right.
And it's really weird that I have this love for him, because he died before I was born. But, like, I've seen every single Elvis movie.
Oh, my God.
Even though they're super politically incorrect, I still love them to this day. One of my favorites is Harum Scarum, and it is so racist. It's so bad.
Arguably, though, Elvis is problematic because he was a white guy that benefited from black music
made
it popular when all of these people did it before. Yes, yeah. He did.
Ain't Nothing About a Hound Dog definitely wasn't. Yeah, it was not his song. Blue Suede Shoes, yep. Not his. I know. But I just love him. There's something about it. If I'm in a bad mood and you put on Blue Hawaii, Girls, 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 Viva Las Vegas, like, I just will be so happy. Like, you can pretty much, those are movies that you can play from the beginning, and I can quote and sing the entire way through any of them. We find out more and more weird things about me as we go on. Like, I'm really starting to get scared of what people start thinking about me, but that's okay. I'm okay in my quirky weirdness.
Yeah, it's what makes this podcast work.
That's true.
So thank you guys so much for listening. Please make sure to like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at SOM Podcast. Don't forget to tell everybody you know about our awesome podcast and encourage them to listen to us. We always like more listeners. Please, if you get the chance, if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. It helps other people find us, helps us move up and be more noticed. So we'd really appreciate it. Plus, we want to know what you think about it. Also, too, if you have any corrections, updates, if you want to let us know that you have registered to vote or filled out your census, email us at stateofmurderpodcast@gmail.com. Send us a Facebook message, an Instagram message, whatever you want. We'll give you a shout out at the beginning of the episode. Also, don't forget to check out stateofmurder.com for any updates, bonus content for each of the episodes that we do. Also, we did get the YouTube link for our interview on Central Valley Talk, so we will be adding that to our State of Murder webpage. So check it out. If you didn't get to hear it live, you can check it out there, or even just search it on YouTube and check it out. And
we're also being featured on another podcast.
Yes, so we will be posting, so keep an eye out on the Facebook and Instagram. We'll be letting you guys know. A friend of ours, his name is Sydney. He does a podcast called Straight Out of Fresno, where he highlights different local issues and things and topics. So he interviewed us for his podcast. So we will be on there, I believe, on August 28th. We will be on his episode of Straight Out of Fresno. So go listen to that, where we talk more about the podcast and yeah, dive deep into some episodes. So thank you guys so much for listening. Next week we are going to be in Alabama. So we're actually moving to the side and then we're going to head up because now we got to do weird things because the country is not a perfect rectangle. So we have to move around in weird ways. So yeah, so we will be in Alabama next week. So we will see you guys next week in Alabama. Bye.
Bye.